Welcome to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Monday, August 17th, 2026. I'm your son, Sounds of Arizona, volunteer broadcaster, Joe Napoli. As is typical for a Monday, we have some in-depth stories as opposed to the hard-breaking news types. On today's cover page, there's a story about honoring Navajo Code Talkers, rural school districts getting housing to support their teachers, and about Republican frustration with the Iran war. The featured photo on today's cover page is some older gentlemen, one sitting in a wheelchair, the other with his right arm on the man's right shoulder. The caption reads, Thomas H. Begay, Wright, one of only two Navajo Code Talkers who are still living with his son, Ronald Begay, during Navajo Code Talker Day at Wesley Bolin Memorial Plaza in Phoenix on August 14th. The accompanying story is titled, It's About the Power of the Language. Navajo Code Talkers Remembered for World War II Heroism by Deborah Uticia Kroll and Alyssa D. Bensenti. Thomas H. Begay was just 16 in 1943 when he persuaded his mother to put her thumbprint on his application to join the U.S. Marines. 2 years later, Begay was relaying vital communications on the beach of Iwo Jima, taking the place of another Marine who had perished during the first days of the pivotal battle that helped turn the tide toward Allied victory in the Pacific theater of World War II. Begay expected to be a gunner, but because he spoke the Navajo language fluently, he was moved into training as a code talker. Begay, now nearly 100, was helped from his wheelchair to stand during the presentation of the colors during the 44th annual Navajo Code Talker Day commemoration on August 14th at the eponymous memorial in Wesley Bolin Memorial Plaza at the Arizona State Capitol. About 100 people braved the 90-degree temperatures to honor the men who put their lives on the line and used a native language, one the nation had once fought to suppress, to help win the war. In Window Rock, the Navajo Nation capital, another ceremony honored the Code Talkers and their families. Annabelle Small Canyon, who was descended from Navajo Code Talker George Willie Sr. and Kellen Little, the descendant of fellow Code Talker and later Arizona State Legislator Arthur Hubbard Sr., sang the national anthem and the Marine Corps hymn in Diné. David Bean, a Pulliup tribal member and chairman of the Indian Gaming Association, said many native languages were taken from native people during the boarding school era. During the first 48 hours of the Iwo Jima battle, Bean said, six Navajo Code Talkers relayed more than 800 messages with no mistakes. Ganano Veterans Organization Vice Commander Lawrence Leno said that as Japanese Emperor Hirohito surrendered to the Allies, he is rumored to have said, the Navajos defeated us. Colton Shone, a Navajo reporter for KTVK and KPHO, honored the Navajo Code Talkers and said, it's about the power of the language to keep people together. The San Carlos Apache Veterans Association presented the colors and provided a 3-round gun salute. During the presentation of a proclamation issued by Governor Katie Hobbs, Code Talker descendants laid a wreath and a flower display at the foot of the Code Talker Memorial, which features a large bronze statue created by Navajo sculptor Orleon Joe. Code Talkers essential to winning battles. Nearly 535 Native men from more than 20 tribes used their languages to help win World Wars I and II for Allied forces. Of those, about 420 were Navajos. Philip Johnson, the son of a missionary who grew up in Letup and learned Navajo, contacted the U.S. Army after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor in December 1941 and drew the U.S. into the war. Johnson heard about how the Army used Comanche Code Talkers and thought the Navajo language could be of service in the war effort. But it was the Marines who decided Navajos were just the ticket to create an unbreakable code after nearly all their previous codes were deciphered. The first cohort of 29 Navajos were recruited in Flagstaff in 1942 and, using the language the United States had done its best to eradicate, created unique terms for military equipment and maneuvers. For example, fighter plane was Da Hai Ti Hai, or Hummingbird. Later, another 400 Young Dene men joined their ranks. The work of the hundreds of code talkers was essential to the Allied victory in World War II. But the Navajo code talkers are best known for the harrowing days of the Pacific battles. They relayed essential intelligence during every major U.S. Marine Corps assault from 1902 to 1945, including Iwo Jima. Later, 5th Marine Division Signal Officer Major Howard Connor would say, "Were it not for the Navajos, the Marines would have never taken Iwo Jima." A long time coming to tell their stories. As a descendant of a Navajo code talker, Michael V. Smith has made it his mission to honor the legacy of his late father, Samuel J. Smith Sr., and the other code talkers he grew up around. Smith is also a Marine Corps veteran. In 1981, he was recruited into a commemorative all-Navajo Marine platoon, composed largely of descendants and relatives of the original World War II Navajo code talkers. The following year, President Ronald Reagan signed a proclamation declaring August 14th as National Navajo Code Talker Day. And for the past 20 years, Smith and other Navajo Code Talker descendants have come together and held a Navajo Code Talkers event for their loved ones in the capital of the Navajo Nation. Smith recalled how reaching that point was a long time coming. "When did you first hear about Navajo Code Talker?" he asked as he addressed the audience at the Navajo Code Talker event in Window Rock. Some were aware of the proclamation in 1982, August 14th, President Reagan. "For me, I was sitting in a Navajo Code Talkers Association meeting with my dad. As a lot of us descendants traveled to these meetings with our dads and sat in these meetings with our dads." Smith's father served as a Navajo Code Talker in the Pacific Theater during World War II. He served with the 4th Marine Division's Headquarters Battalion Communications Company and survived the battles of Rai, Namur, Saipan, Tinian, and Iwo Jima. The meeting was adjourned to have lunch at the Golden Corral in honor of Navajo Code Talker Day, Smith said. Never hearing about this day, Smith asked his dad, "Navajo Code Talkers Day, what's that?" He opened up his briefcase and pulled out the proclamation from 1982, recalled Smith. "I sat there and read, and I said, dang, the whole United States was ordered by the president to expend resources to celebrate the Navajo Code Talkers. Every town, every county, every state. The whole United States was ordered in the proclamation by President Ronald Reagan. The Navajo Nation, when called upon to serve the United States, contributed a precious commodity never before used in this way," the Reagan proclamation read, using an old spelling for the Dene. "In the midst of the fighting in the Pacific during World War II, a gallant group of men from the Navajo Nation utilized their language in coded form to help speed the Allied victory. Equipped with the only foolproof, unbreakable code in the history of warfare, the code talkers confused the enemy with an earful of sounds never before heard by code experts. The dedication and unswerving devotion to duty shown by the men of the Navajo Nation in serving as radio code talkers in the Marine Corps during World War II should serve as a fine example for all Americans," part of the 1982 proclamation wrote. Why can't we celebrate our men like this? In 1968, Navajo Code Talker operation was declassified. However, even after the operation was made public, the World War II heroes were not widely celebrated through special events. That changed when Smith was assigned by the Navajo Code Talkers Association to help the veterans attend the Iwo Jima flag-raising event in Sacaton, Arizona. Smith was floored by the event and wondered how he could begin to bring the same type of celebration to the Navajo Nation to honor the Navajo Code Talkers. "I thought, why can't we do this in Window Rock for our Navajo Code Talkers?" Smith said. "Why can't we celebrate our men like this?" Smith emotionally recalled how, during a Navajo Code Talkers Association meeting, after the two Iwo Jima event, he was placed on the agenda and when it was his time to present, he asked, "Can I throw you a party in Window Rock for Navajo Code Talker Day?" The men, they all voted with a raise of hand. "We vote to have Michael Smith throw us a party for Navajo Code Talker Day in Window Rock," said Smith, as his voice cracked with emotion. That's when planning parties became fun, because these men were so easy to please. They were so humble. They were so grateful for everything you gave them. "Everything I did, my dad, he valued somebody saying thank you more than the silver medal he received from Congress." On July 26, 2001, Navajo Code Talkers who served in World War II received the Congressional Silver Medal in a White House ceremony, while the original 29 Code Talkers who created the Unbreakable Code received Congressional Gold Medals. Subsequent Code Talker graduates received the silver duplicate. Smith said, as August 14, 2004 started getting closer, he went to the then Joe Shirley administration and proposed the event. The following year they had a parade, and in December 2006 the Navajo Nation officially established August 14th as a permanent tribal holiday. When the event was first held, approximately 66 Navajo Code Talkers were still living. About half attended Navajo Code Talker Day in Window Rock with their families. Smith said the event drew about 200 people in total. Smith smiled as he recalled the late New Mexico State Senator and Navajo Code Talker John Pinto attended the annual event every year until his death. "Today is about Navajo Code Talkers," Smith said. "It's about celebrating your Navajo Code Talker, our Navajo Code Talkers. I want to thank everybody who takes the time to celebrate Navajo Code Talkers in your own way. There's no right or wrong way. Well, there is a wrong way. If you want to make money on it, that's the wrong way to do it. The right way to do it is from your heart." Smith thanked the descendants for giving him the opportunity to work alongside their fathers and to hear their stories and to get to know them over the years. "To hear them call your name, it was really special for me to remember how the men said my name, and for that love, I love and respect them," Smith said. "I wish I could do so much more for these men, and we can. We can together. If we do it all together, we can make this a global holiday." Keeping the story alive. Keeping the story of the Navajo Code Talkers' heroism alive has had its ups and downs. The records of all the Code Talkers' exploits were classified for 23 years until 1968. The soldiers returning home were not allowed to tell what they did or how their actions turned the tide of battles. After the records were declassified, their exploits became legend. The Code Talkers, including the Navajos, were acclaimed as heroes. Congressional gold medals were distributed by tribe. Congressional silver medals were awarded to individual service members in 2001 by President George W. Bush. They also earned standard military decorations like Purple Hearts and Silver Stars after their classified World War I and World War II missions were declassified. Books, movies, documentaries, and events like the August 14th commemoration helped keep their story fresh in the public eye and to Indian country. The story dimmed a bit when the Defense Department removed references to the Code Talkers, but quickly returned them after a public outcry in 2025. Just two of the estimated 420 Navajos who served as Code Talkers are still living, Begay and former Navajo Nation Chairman Peter McDonald. Deborah Kroll reports on indigenous communities at the confluence of climate, culture, and commerce in Arizona and the Intermountain Rest. Reach Kroll at debra.krol@azcentral.com. We stay in Arizona as we turn to an article titled, "Rural Districts Offer Housing Benefit to Draw More Teachers," by Eric Trevino. School districts in rural Arizona are deploying a new tool in an effort to address the statewide teacher shortage. They're becoming landlords. From Prescott to the reservations in Pima County, schools have begun including affordable housing in teachers' contract to help fill classrooms. Arizona loses double the number of teachers when compared with the national average according to state and national data. Over 8,600, or about 14% of Arizona's teachers left the profession entirely in the 2024-25 school year, much larger than the national rate of 7.1%. According to a survey from the Arizona Department of Education in 2026, the largest factor contributed to teachers leaving the profession for that school year was wanting or needing a higher salary, with roughly 1 in 4 teachers citing compensation as their reason. Working in a rural district is extremely challenging, said Babo Kuvardi School District Superintendent Ruben Diaz. Not a lot of people, especially young people, want to pack and leave everything behind. Rural schools have instead found a different way to recruit and retain staff, one that will put more money in teachers' pockets without having to raise salaries. Superintendent of Prescott Unified School District Clark Tenney said he's lived in Prescott for 43 years and watched it grow from a family town to a retirement community. It's caused the cost of living in Prescott to skyrocket, particularly housing. Tenney said the district pays teachers roughly 5 to 6% below the state average. When he served as the district's human resources director, Tenney said some newly hired teachers backed out after realizing how expensive Prescott was. Data from Zillow, a real estate marketplace, shows the median listing price for a home in Prescott is over $700,000. The district, through a partnership with the city, allocated funds to build a total of 6 two-bedroom housing units for the staff. The units are available for $1,000 a month, which Tenney said is roughly half the market rate. Tenants are allowed to stay in the unit for 1 year, which buys them time for new hires to find other housing once the lease ends. The program, he said, has received positive feedback from teachers, giving them a great start and subsequently encouraging them to stay within the district. It's a recruiting tool, but then it also kind of helps with our retention in that we get our top choice candidates and they tend to stay with us, Tenney said. Third grade teacher Risa Abreu said she found the housing to be a big help during her transition from Central Arizona, where the cost of living was cheaper. Even regardless of where you were in life, it's always tough to make a big move, but Prescott has some great kids and they need great teachers, she said. The housing really makes it more possible for us. Abreu said affordable housing relieves financial pressures, allowing teachers to devote more attention to their work. Ahead of the school year, a fellow district employee living in the units helped her get ready for her first day. She came to help me set up my classroom, since I didn't have any family up here anymore, she said. So that was amazing, to have a little built-in community right here. Rural districts adopt similar strategies for teacher retention. The Chino Valley Unified School District in Yavapai County also incorporated teacher housing during a time when finding professionals was an issue. Now its enrollment has steadied, and the district has been able to open its one-bedroom units to its certified and classified staff for $650 a month. Originally intended as a 3-year lease, tenants may stay longer depending on their circumstances, Assistant Superintendent of Chino Valley, Marty Capitelli, said. The district can offer one of its 10 units as transitional housing for staff who are relocating or going through a divorce. Still, gathering funds to build new housing on district property can be challenging. In Prescott Unified, the district gathered a third of the funds, roughly $500,000, from a federal grant distributed through the Arizona Department of Education to be used exclusively for teacher housing. Another third came from the district's own funds, and the last $500,000 came from the city of Prescott in exchange for putting first responders and city personnel in 2 of the 6 units for the next 30 years. In Chino Valley, Campitelli said the district had received grants to build teacher housing, but they also put in $1 million of their own dollars, which could take the district 2 decades before they repay their debts. He said the district was able to secure some good teachers in the long run through this initiative, but is not looking to make any future additions. The district has also experienced a decline in enrollment, making the need to hire new teachers less of an issue than when the housing was initially built. The financial commitment is sometimes hard to look at when we're looking at our budget, especially in slimmer times as now. But ultimately, I am proud of the fact that we have this, that we can offer this to a number of employees, Capitelli said. In Pima County, Babo Kuvardi District Unified has a total of 41 units for its staff, with plans to expand further, according to Diaz. Staff housing starts at $200 a month and goes up to $350. Employees sign a yearly contract that can be renewed and have the option to choose a one-bedroom, two-bedroom, or three-bedroom unit. Diaz said offering housing allows the district to stay competitive by presenting new hires with their salaries compared to their potential savings. Currently, all 41 units are occupied with a handful of staff on the waiting list. Bubba Kovari Unified is also looking to expand its housing assistance further by using impact aid funds the school receives from the federal government for establishing buildings on tax-free land like military bases, low-rent housing, and national parks. Because reservations were exempt from taxes, the district earns 10 cents for every dollar the federal government would have paid in taxes, bringing the district roughly $9 million a year. One of the plans to expand involves purchasing tiny homes from nearby Globe Unified School District. According to Diaz, after Globe Unified bought the homes and could not get the construction approved, it was willing to sell to Bubba Kovari Unified for an affordable price. Another advantage of the housing, Diaz said, is the teachers who participate in the program tend to stay longer. Not only is it a way for the district to recruit and retain teachers, he said, but it brings financial and emotional stability as teachers fall in love with the community. Once you have a home, that is the root. You connect with that community, and you stay with that community, he said. Coverage of Education Solutions on azcentral.com and in the Arizona Republic is partially supported by a grant from the Arizona Local News Foundation's Arizona Community Collaborative Fund. Before we finish the front page, let me remind you that you can listen to our programs on the Internet. Go to our website, sunsounds.org. Click the link labeled Broadcast, Info, and Audio. On the left side of the page, there will be a box labeled Programming Links, with a link to listen live, as well as a link for on-demand programs. We wrap today's front page with a USA Today article titled GOP Grows Anxious for End to Iran War by Zach Anderson, Francesca Chambers, and Zachary Shermale. President Donald Trump is under increasing pressure from members of his party to find a way out of the Iran war with the midterms on the horizon and Republican voters souring on a conflict that he once predicted would last just a handful of weeks. Republicans are airing their frustrations publicly and privately about what they see as muddled messaging coming out of the administration on a conflict that's driven up prices for voters. A growing number of prominent MAGA figures have urged Trump to end the war, saying there could be dire political consequences if it continues. Republican strategists have echoed these concerns, saying a major drag on the party heading in November. Trump has alternated between threats and diplomatic overtures to get the job done, but the war is now approaching 6 months with no end in sight. Election Day is less than 3 months away, and the administration has resorted to insisting that the fundamentals of the economy are strong, but the rate of inflation remains higher than it was before the conflict began or before Trump took office, coming in at 3.4% in July. The war has pushed gas prices above $4 a gallon and driven up other costs, contributing to affordability concerns that are top of mind for many voters. It's one of those issues where there's almost no upside, GOP pollster and Senegal founder Brent Buchanan said of the Iran war. The protracted conflict has put GOP lawmakers on the defensive as they spend an extended congressional recess in their districts. Retiring Senator Tom Tillis, Republican of North Carolina, said anxiety over the Iran war may mean it's time for some Republican lawmakers to separate from the White House on the war, which has hurt the president's approval rating and threatened the GOP's chances of maintaining control of Congress. Lawmakers said the war dominated the conversation when Vice President J.D. Vance met privately with Senate Republicans on Capitol Hill before their August recess. Senator John Kennedy, Republican of Louisiana, told reporters afterward that Vance and other top administration officials would hold a news conference to explain Trump's rationale for going to war. Kennedy said he worried that the American people are somewhat confused about why we went in and where we are. Negative public opinion on the conflict is putting Republican members of Congress in an awkward position as they fan out over the August recess, some campaigning for re-election and others supporting colleagues who are on the ballot. Some express nervousness over how they'll handle the topic. Internal messaging guidance circulated among the Senate Republican Conference in July acknowledged that high fuel costs linked to the war are a problem. The strategy document obtained by USA Today urged GOP senators to say they are very concerned about the price of gas and want to make sure prices come down. Trump was elected in part on a promise to bring down inflation, making the surge in gas prices and its overall impact on inflation a particular concern, said GOP pollster Whit Ayers. Democrats are promising to press the issue on the campaign trail. This election is going to be a referendum on this war that Donald Trump is losing, Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, said August 9th on NBC's Meet the Press. Most Republican lawmakers continue to publicly back Trump's approach to Iran, with only a smattering voting to end the war. But prominent MAGA figures have been increasingly outspoken about their desire for Trump to focus on domestic issues. Conservative media figures such as Matt Gaetz, a former Florida lawmaker, and online influencer Benny Johnson have called on Trump to end the war. Foreign wars with no end in sight are always unpopular. They will always be political cancer, especially with young people, Johnson wrote on social media July 30th. End the war. Be done. Refocus on America. Gas, grocery, home prices, and immigration. That's how we win. Fox News host Laura Ingraham outlined the political peril for Republicans on her show in July. With the midterm elections a little more than 100 days away, the clock is ticking for President Trump to get out of this war before voters head to the polls. It's making a lot of Republicans nervous, Ingraham said, adding, Republicans cannot let this become an endless distraction, especially if they want to win in November. Polling shows the war deeply unpopular, with only 36% of Americans approving of Trump's handling of the conflict in Iran, according to Real Clear Politics' polling average of numerous polls. Even among Republicans, just 61% approved in an AP NORC survey taken July 23rd to 27, down from 71% in a previous survey. We've gotten to the point where about the only people who still support the war in Iran are those who strongly approve of Donald Trump's job performance overall, Ayers said. Yet, even the president's diehard supporters are becoming more anxious about the costs associated with the war. In a July survey conducted for Politico by the independent polling firm Public First, 37% of self-identified MAGA voters said Trump should only stay in the war if it doesn't increase costs, a jump from the 29% who shared the same sentiments in May. Trump allies fret that the conflict is hurting the president's appeal as his support dips among white working-class voters and other groups that have powered his victories. You are listening to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Monday, August 17th, 2026. I'm your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Joe Napoli. Your voter registration can be affected by any number of things, such as moving or not voting in recent elections. In Maricopa County, to register or check on your registration status, go to beballotready.vote. Outside Maricopa County, go to myarizona.vote. If you're not registered, you'd have to register by October 5th for the November 3rd general election. You can receive and send your ballot by mail by enrolling in the active early voting list. The caption for the featured photo on the Valley and State page says it all. Former Mercury Guard and WNBA legend Diana Taurasi stands with her four-year-old daughter Isla and Phoenix Mercury mascot Scorch in front of her new mural after it was unveiled at the Mortgage Matchup Center on August 13th. Sean Raimondo details an issue in Scottsdale with an article titled, Scottsdale Photo Radar Tickets Often Tossed. In-person delivery rule spurs many dismissals. Scottsdale collects an average of nearly $3 million annually from drivers caught speeding past its photo radar cameras, city financial records showed. Whether the city stands to earn more revenue from lead-footed drivers is another challenge for Scottsdale's police and municipal court. According to the city, nearly half of the city's photo enforcement cases over the past 5.5 years have been dismissed because drivers couldn't be served their civil traffic citations. Based on reader responses to the Arizona Republic's recent story about Scottsdale Mayor Lisa Borowski's dodging speeding a ticket, many drivers appear to ignore the citations altogether. "Everyone avoids those things," a Reddit user stated this week. Dave Saunders, the general manager of Course Restaurant in Scottsdale, noted that the mayor's situation is a familiar occurrence. "She didn't get served by the court after multiple attempts and the ticket got thrown out," he commented on Instagram about the Republic's post about Borowski. "You can do the exact same thing. You just don't get to do traffic school if you try to hide and they find you." Here's what we know about the city's photo enforcement program and how social media users are weighing in. What are people saying about Scottsdale Mayor Lisa Borowski's $334 speeding ticket? News of Borowski's ticket incited a mix of responses on social media channels like Instagram, Reddit, and X. Some comments were critical of the mayor, calling her a politician who is above the law. Others, however, defended her. "Don't hate the player, hate the game," a Redditor wrote. "Hell yeah, good for her," another stated. "I've done this about a dozen times, LOL," one gleefully boasted. "I've literally done the same thing and never got in trouble," another Redditor flouted. Another user was honest about their feelings toward Borowski. "Not a fan of the mayor, but she did nothing wrong here." With several others echoing the sentiment, many also argued that Scottsdale should eliminate its photo enforcement program and any other surveillance technology like Flock's controversial license plate readers. "Good for her. We've done the same thing," another Redditor stated. "If I were running for office, I'd proudly say so and vote to remove the cameras, be they red light, speed, or Flock." Borowski did not respond to text messages seeking comment for this story. How did Borowski avoid paying the speeding fine? Last October, a camera near Thomas and Scottsdale Roads snapped Borowski allegedly traveling 18 miles an hour over the speed limit, according to authorities. Scottsdale police said a citation was mailed to her on October 31st, but she never acknowledged it. That prompted the city's contract process servers to locate Borowski to deliver the citation, which authorities said carried a $334 fine. Scottsdale Municipal Court ultimately dismissed the case in February after the mayor couldn't be located at her home, police explained. Borowski said this week that she never received a ticket and couldn't respond to something she had no idea about. When asked August 13th, in a text to clarify if she meant a mail ticket or a process server, she didn't respond. How much money does Scottsdale generate from photo radar cameras? Arizona continues to be branded as one of the deadliest states for pedestrians and one of the most dangerous for fatal crashes involving red light runners. To curb speeding on their roadways, communities like Scottsdale, and most recently Phoenix, have used photo radar cameras. Scottsdale launched its photo enforcement program in 1996. Over the last 5 years, it's provided the city with about $2.8 million annually on average. That's roughly a third of the city's annual revenue from fines, fees, and forfeitures, according to the city's yearly financial reports. Maintaining its photo enforcement program costs the city about $1 million a year. Authorities tasked with tracking down speeders. When a driver is caught speeding by a camera and receives a speeding ticket in the mail, they can generally choose to either admit responsibility and pay the fine, deny responsibility and request a hearing, or attend defensive driving school if the violation and driver qualify. Some, however, don't believe they have to pay the ticket or that by ignoring it, it will go away. Between January 1, 2021 and June 30, 2026, nearly 296,000 photo enforcement cases were filed in Scottsdale Municipal Court. About 130,000 of them, or 44%, were dismissed because the driver was never served a citation. State law requires cities to personally present drivers with civil citations. if police or process servers are unable to do so within 90 days of a citation's filing in municipal court, and the case will oftentimes get dismissed. As one comment on Instagram noted, it's called due process. Like this story? Get more East Valley news straight to your email inbox by signing up for our free weekly East Valley newsletter, which comes out on Wednesdays. Sean Raimondo covers Scottsdale. Reach him at SRAYMUNDO@gannett.com. Our next story comes to us north of Scottsdale and is titled Book Ban Backlash Spurs Peoria Unified DEI Review by Alexandra Hartle. Peoria Unified School District officials say they're open to revisiting the district's anti-DEI policy after backlash over the removal of three books from middle school English classes. The board asked district personnel to arrange a roundtable discussion for community members to weigh in on the policy, although a date for that hasn't been set yet. The district faced backlash when it announced that books would be banned from the respective 6th, 7th, and 8th grade curricula. The district cited three policies that led to the elimination of the books: curriculum adoption, instructional protocols for controversial topics, and prohibition of diversity, equity, and inclusion. The school board at an August 13th meeting faced more criticism from the public, who raised concerns about the district's anti-DEI policy and the importance of the books. But some district personnel maintained they were simply following protocol outlined by the board to develop the curriculum, leading some to question the district's curriculum adoption process. Interim Superintendent Talia Vistantier said the purpose of the anti-DEI policy was to ensure that instructional materials reflect academic rigor and factual accuracy. The district is still meeting requirements under the federal anti-discrimination statutes, she said. For grade 6, Vistantier said Summer of the Mariposas by Guadalupe Garcia McCall was pulled because the committee identified it had profanity, descriptions of abuse, and references to sexual innuendos and prostitution. A Raisin in the Sun by Lorraine Hansberry, which was meant to be part of the grade 7 curriculum, was pulled because it has references to alcohol abuse, unintended pregnancy, and abortion and racial slurs. The book is still available in advanced placement language arts classes and is still available in high school libraries, Vistantier said. For grade 8, Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass by Frederick Douglass was taken out of the curriculum because the book contains racial slurs, sexual references, and graphic descriptions of abuse inflicted on enslaved people. Vistantier said lessons about Frederick Douglass are still taught in grades 5, 7, and 8, and the book is also available in high school AP courses and high school libraries. Our community already did not trust us, board members said. Board President Jeff Toby maintained the books did not get removed because of the anti-DEI policy, but rather the age appropriateness of the materials. Board member Heather Brooks, the former president of the board and a leading supporter of the anti-DEI policy, maintained that she did not ask for any books to be removed. She said she was made aware of staff members' concerns about profanity and sexual contents of the books. Brooks said she asked Vistantier in July to go over the library portion of the curriculum, but was never able to schedule a time to see it. Brooks also said she has concerns about the age appropriateness of the content, and the fifth graders learn about Douglass in their history class. Brooks criticized the way district handled the situation, saying the district should have mentioned concerns around age appropriateness, as opposed to placing blame on the anti-DEI policy. Board member Becky Proudfit said she sees the board needs to revisit the policy with community members. Good policy should not lead to ambiguity or gray areas, Proudfit said. Proudfit also expressed concerns about teachers being afraid to teach the wrong things in the classroom. What is not okay is for us to create policy that puts handcuffs on our teachers and creates a situation where they're afraid to teach for retribution from any of us or from the district or from anyone else, Proudfit said. Board member Melissa Ewing said the district needs to revisit the policy and that the directives given to the textbook committee and to the administration came from the board. Ewing was the lone board member to vote against the anti-DEI policy when it was passed in late 2025. I think our board needs to take responsibility for the harmful rhetoric that we have had up here against a lot of marginalized communities. If we didn't have that harmful rhetoric that has come from the dais, I don't think we would have such a backlash, Ewing said. Ewing said the board should engage in conversations with the community about what should be in the curriculum. She said the anti-DEI policy should be made less vague if the board won't get rid of it. I think our community already did not trust us to be able to make good judgments, Ewing said. Parents question board policy. Several parents spoke out against the policy and the book removals at the meeting. Some questioned the district's reasoning about appropriateness, saying kids were already subjected to things like violence in TV and movies. Carrie Cooper with the West Valley NAACP spoke at the meeting and said Peoria Unified Anti-DEI Policy has been escalated to the state and national NAACP. We want to know why books were removed by Black authors. We want to know why books were removed by Latino authors. We're not here to debate any of these books would run parallel with Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn, Cooper said. Jerry Piazza, the district director of teaching and learning, said there are few English language arts standards in literature at the middle school level. The standards are set by the Arizona Department of Education. While the district can choose the novel or textbook to teach a specific standard, these can be revised over time, Piazza said. Piazza said a textbook selection committee reviewed each book page by page to ensure that all the materials were in alignment with governing board policies. New people were added throughout the process to ensure different perspectives, she said. We go from school board to electoral politics with an article titled Heap's Bid for Thousands in Public Funding is Successful by Lana Mendinger. Corporation Commission candidate Ralph Heap can now access hundreds of thousands of dollars in public campaign funding that were frozen in July. Heap's funding has been tied up since he qualified for the public financing program in July, pending the submission of a sworn statement certifying that his campaign finance reports are accurate. That statement was submitted this week. Although the Citizens Clean Elections Commission voted to release the funds after the month-long delay, they unanimously voted that there was reason to believe the Heap campaign had violated campaign finance rules or statutes. As the November election approaches, the time was of the essence, Heap's attorney said at the August 14th meeting. I'm sure you'll be hounding Dr. Heap for a long time, but that will be a campaign finance complaint, said Timothy Lasota. Essentially, we need our money now because we have a campaign to run. Arizona Corporation Commission hopefuls running in the Clean Elections program were eligible for $147,836 for primary election and $221,915 for the general election. The commission voted 3-1 to release funding and 4-0 on the merits of a complaint that claimed Heap didn't report the full cost of campaign signs at an August 14th special meeting, launching further investigation into the claims. Clean Elections Executive Director Tom Collins recommended the commission continue to withhold funding, given evidence that campaign finance violations had occurred. Earlier this month, the commission voted to deny Heap's request to leave the public financing program, barring the candidate from raising private dollars. Heap received a wave of support from voters during public comment at the August 14th meeting, who urged the commission to either release him from the program or distribute the public financing. Several speakers said they had felt the process had been weaponized against Heap. After a handful of commentators expressed dismay at the prospect of losing Heap as an option in the November general election, Commissioner Christine Estes Werther clarified that 5 days preceding would not remove him from the ballot. Heap beat incumbent Nick Myers in the July Republican primary. He and current Commissioner Kevin Thompson will head to the November election to face Democrats Clara Pratt and Jonathan Hill. Currently, all 5 members of the Arizona Corporation Commission are Republicans. Public commenter Barbara Parker said the Clean Elections rules can be onerous and Heap should be given the opportunity to correct any mistakes. Let's err on the side of not disenfranchising the voters and take care of this administratively and put it to bed, Parker said. Lasota said the campaign had received conflicting guidance on what would lead to the release of the public financing. He compared the limbo the campaign was left in after the commission's vote to keep people in the program, but before release of the funds to something out of the old Soviet Union. If the commission just has a politically disfavored candidate it doesn't want to fund, it doesn't have to fund him, Lasota said. Commission Chair Mark Kimball bristled at the suggestion that proceedings were biased. I'm not going to rebut what you say, but I do take issue with one thing you said. This is an issue based on the political leanings of your client, which is nonsense, Kimball said. The commission has two independents, two Republicans, one Democrat. The political position of your client is immaterial to us. Heap's campaign received a complaint that claimed a discrepancy between the number of signs supporting the orthopedic surgeon and state legislator and the repeated spending on signage. Campaign finance reports show an expenditure of roughly $650, while other candidates have spent thousands. His attorney wrote in a letter that the small figure paid to Mesa Sign Shop was because the order was made on credit. In an affidavit, Mesa Sign Shop owner Jim Torgerson wrote that he provided the signs to Heap because of the candidate's creditworthiness and the size of the order, a decision he indicated was not unusual. But Collins argues the April transaction was out of the ordinary and the agreement should have been reported the day it was made. Other candidates showed much higher spending with the same vendor within the same time frame, according to his recommendation. While it's unclear how many signs Heap bought or what the total cost will be, Collins wrote that by agreeing to buy signs on credit, it appeared that Heap's campaign had taken on more debt than it had earned. By the end of March, Heap had raised roughly $10,000. Dr. Heap's campaign finance report suggests his campaign committee did not have sufficient cash to pay Mesa Sign when he placed the order in late April, when the signed order was completed in late May, or at any point prior to qualifying for clean elections funding, Collins wrote. Dr. Heap has not provided any information that would counter this. Collins rejected an argument that the extension of credit fell under an exemption and didn't require reporting. Dr. Heap obtained goods and services from Mesa Sign Shop, which he has not yet paid for, and his campaign finance reports do not disclose the transactions, which they must, in my view, Collins wrote. This transaction and failure to report represent illegal activity that goes to the heart of Dr. Heap's agreement to participate as a clean elections candidate. A sign of the times. The complaint regarding Heap's signs is one of several filed in the Arizona Corporation Commission race with the Citizens Clean Elections Commission. In January, a complaint alleged that David Marshall, who planned to run alongside Heap, had inappropriately injected funds from an old campaign account into his Corporation Commission bid. The complaint was closed in April when Marshall accepted an appointment as the Navajo County Recorder and withdrew from the race. On July 15th, incumbents Mayers and Thompson received a complaint claiming they too had failed to disclose the full cost for their campaign signs. The pair said the signs were reused from 2022, so spending on the signs this election cycle was minimal. A new complaint filed August 13th against Mayers and Thompson claims the pair should have paid their old campaign for the reuse of the signs in the 2026 cycle. Heap is also facing a second complaint, which similarly alleges that spending reported on professional signature gathering did not reflect the extent of services provided. Reach Energy, Tech, and Utilities reporter Alina Meisinger by email at alaina.meisinger@usatodayco.com. You can listen to Sun Sounds on your smart home device, such as an Amazon Echo or Google Home. Ask the device to play Sun Sounds of Arizona. You can also take us with you on our free dedicated mobile app available for both iPhone and Android smartphones. We have a tragic story titled Peoria Parents Tried to Help Their Son But Ended Up Dead by Elena Santa Cruz. Frazier Scott and Tina Turk were dedicated to helping their adult son who had serious mental illness, but he wasn't doing so well around spring 2026. Neighbors told Peoria police that Scott Turk wanted their son, Jonathan Turk, out of their house. Tina Turk refused. Weeks later, around 6:30 p.m. on March 31st, Jonathan Turk called 911 and told them the emergency was murder, according to a transcription of the call detailed in the police report obtained by the Arizona Republic through a public records request. He said he killed his parents with a hammer and a knife because he was angry about the medication they put him on, the report said. It was later found that Jonathan Turk had bought the hammer earlier that day, identifying the one he wanted, after testing various ones in the palm of his hand and head, the report said. Jonathan Turk, 29, told the 911 dispatcher his parents were in the house, the weapons were in his room. It was too late for CPR to save his parents, and he agreed to stay on the phone until police arrived at his family home near 83rd Avenue and Jomax Road. He also said he had mental health issues, but did not want to talk about medications or answer whether he had previously thought about killing his parents over his medications, according to the report. There was blood throughout some rooms of the house, according to the report. Scott Turk, 63, was lying on the stairway, and Tina Turk, 56, was lying face down in the bathroom of the main bedroom. Police said in the report that both had clear injuries and lots of blood on them. There was evidence of violent struggle, police said in the report. A hammer and a knife with blood on them were clearly seen inside a trash can in Jonathan Turk's bedroom, the report said. In a post-arrest statement, Jonathan Turk told police he was drinking beer and smoking marijuana a few hours before the incident, the report said. He told police his age and told police he wanted a lawyer. Among the items found in the home during the investigation were old holiday and birthday cards that Jonathan Turk gave his parents. Some had handwritten messages in which he thanked them for their support and shared that he loved them, the report said. Some officers who assisted in the investigation said they knew the Turk family had previous encounters with Jonathan Turk. Since 2023, he had mental health delusions, the report said, including sending threatening letters to churches in Arizona and California, which in part he said he wanted to kill President Donald Trump. His family had been working to get him help, and he was placed under court-ordered mental health treatment, the report said. The couple worked in the health field and were educated about serious mental illness, according to previous reporting by the Republic. They attended a weeks-long education session to help families navigate having adult loved ones with serious mental illness in 2023. They also attended a support group for families affected by mental illness. In the days after the killing, one neighbor told police Scott Turk had recently said that Jonathan Turk wasn't doing well and relapsed, the report said. The neighbor also said Tina Turk shared that her son had stopped taking his prescribed medications and was instead using marijuana, the report said. Other neighbors also told the police they knew Jonathan Turk was struggling or behaving oddly, the report said. Tina Turk never shared that he believed her son would hurt her or her husband, one neighbor told police, the report said. But a handwritten note found in her purse indicated she knew he wasn't doing well. His decision to break trust will never be acceptable. However, he is human, with hurts and pains, and he tried to kill his pain with the wrong medication, the note read, according to the police report. Jonathan Turk is now facing two counts of first-degree murder. He is also accused of attempting to commit first-degree murder, aggravated assault, and disorderly conduct for another incident that occurred days after his arrest on April 10th, according to the Maricopa County Superior Court website. He is being held on a $3 million bond, according to the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office website. Republic reporter Stephanie Innes contributed this article. Have a news tip? Contact the Arizona Republic and ACCentral.com at newstips@arizonarepublic.com. We finish hour one with a story titled Cinema Details Sex with Bodyguard in Homewrecker Case by Stephanie Murray. Kirsten Cinema disclosed having sex multiple times with her then-married former bodyguard, Matthew Amel, in various cities across the country in a deposition as part of her homewrecker lawsuit she is facing in North Carolina. Cinema, a former Democrat turned independent U.S. Senator from Arizona, is being sued by Heather Amel, the ex-wife of Matthew Amel. She is accused of breaking up their 14-year marriage. Cinema, who is not married, did not deny the coast-to-coast affair. Instead, she argued it did not happen in North Carolina, so she shouldn't be sued under the state's rare homewrecker law. In a July 31st deposition, Cinema said she first had sex with Matthew Amel in 2024. Cinema and Matthew Amel were staying at an Airbnb in Napa, California around Memorial Day when they first kissed, she said. We were staying in an Airbnb in Napa, California. We were outside. Matt kissed me. We went inside and had sex, Cinema said, according to a deposition transcript. They were at the property with Cinema's friends Grant and Penny Croissant and another member of her security team, Cinema said. The affair continued a month later when Cinema attended the wedding of CNN anchor Jessica Dean in New York City. Cinema and Matthew Amel had separate hotel rooms at the Edison Hotel in Midtown Manhattan. They were intimate in Cinema's room, she said in a deposition. Cinema and Matthew Amel continued having sex at her Washington, D.C. apartment in July 2024 and in Aspen, Colorado during a late August 2024 fundraising trip. Cinema said she did not recall whether they had another encounter in Washington in late September, though Matthew Amel confirmed they did in his deposition. The affair continued into October at her house in Phoenix. Cinema made the comments during a deposition at a law office in Raleigh. The documents were filed August 12th in the U.S. District Court for the Middle District of North Carolina, Western Division. A lawyer also pressed Cinema on text messages she sent to Matthew Amel, including a picture of Cinema in a towel. She said the report was about sports because she is an endurance athlete and the photo was of her cupping marks. In another message, Cinema said, "Putting my hand on your heart, I'll see you soon. I miss you." Is that the type of message you sent to other security guards or other members of your security detail? The lawyer asked. Cinema said she cannot recall whether she sent a similar message to her other security detail. "You understand, Miss Cinema, don't you, that a wife reading this might get concerned about who is sending her husband that kind of message referring to putting her hand on his heart? Can you see that?" the lawyer asked. Cinema answered yes. Heather Amel also sat for a deposition on the case. She agreed she cannot dispute that the romantic and sexual relationship between Cinema and Matthew Amel happened exclusively outside of North Carolina before November 1, 2024, when the couple separated. The next step in the case will be an evidentiary hearing on August 19th, according to court documents. Stephanie Murray covers national politics and the Trump administration for the Arizona Republic and azcentral.com. She co-hosts The Gaggle, the Republic's weekly politics podcast. Reach her at stephanie.murray@usatodayco.com. That is it for Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Monday, August 17, 2026. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Joe Napoli, thanking you for listening to Hour 1 and encouraging you to stay tuned for Hour 2 and our other great programs here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.